very same documents WikiLeaks has published since 2009. And I have been able to do this completely safely. I was never put in prison. I was never questioned. And so I feel the urgency to speak out and to use my safe position as a professional journalist to tell people how absurd and completely unacceptable this double standard, where I'm completely safe and so are all of the media partners, some dozens of journalists from the New York Times to the Japanese newspapers, completely safe, completely happy. We got scoops. We publish gorgeous journalism thanks to Julian Assange, thanks to Chelsea Manning. Now we have been completely safe and they are in prison. Chelsea tried to commit suicide 3 times. Julian has spent 10 years confined and then now he's in a high security prison. He can die any moment if he gets infected by coronavirus. So I feel a professional and ethical duty to speak out and to use my safe position to tell people how completely unacceptable is this situation and how we have to take the strict and act before it is too late. In 2015, when Julian had already spent 5 years confined, 3 of them in the embassy without even an hour outdoor. We give an hour outdoor to some of the worst mafia people who kill children. Julian has never had an hour outdoors in 7 years inside the embassy. So in 2015, I realized that no journalists have tried to get the documents about this case, to try to investigate this case using factual documentation. So it was at that point that I basically decided to start my Freedom of Information Act investigation. And just because I wanted to get the facts, I want something factual to try to understand what was going on. And an Italian prosecutor had basically told me why there is such a paralysis in this criminal investigation in Sweden. And they said, there is such paralysis because the Swedish prosecutor don't want to go to London to question him. And this is stopping everything, is creating this paralysis. And he said, you should try to discover why they don't want to go there, because we travel the world to question very dangerous people, mafia bosses and so on. We travel to Brazil, everywhere. So why they cannot travel to London to question him? So it was at that point that I decided to file my freedom of information request in Sweden. And initially, Sweden was really collaborative. And that was my strategy. My strategy was, if I can get any information from Sweden, which is an open jurisdiction when it comes to freedom of information, I can use whatever I get from Sweden as a picklock to get information from other jurisdictions which are less effective, less open when it comes to freedom of information. And it worked. It worked because the Swedish authorities provide me very few documents, just 226 pages, but crucial, because thanks to these documents, it was possible to understand that the British authority were calling the shot in the Swedish investigation, which is very weird. Why they, what kind of special interest they had in this case, the Swedish investigation, considering that it was a Swedish alleged rape. So why they were calling the shot, why they were telling the Swedish prosecutors not to question Julian Assange in London, which is basically the decision, which basically the reason why there was this legal and diplomatic quagmire, the refusal to go to London to question him and to decide whether to charge him or whether to drop the investigation once and for all. So thanks to this email I got from Sweden under the Freedom of Information Act, it was possible to establish that it was the UK Crown Prosecution Service who had told the Swedish prosecutor, don't come to London to question him, questioning only after extraditing him. And thanks to these documents, it was possible to establish that back in 2013, even the Swedish prosecutor started to questioning the UK strategy of not questioning Julian Assange in London, but just extraditing him to Sweden. So even the Swedish prosecutor in 2003 realized that this was creating a judicial paralysis, a diplomatic paralysis, because at that point there was even a diplomatic case in addition to the legal case. So at that point, the Swedish prosecutors considered to drop the investigation in 2003. But again, the UK, the UK Crown Prosecution Service told them, don't you dare get cold feet. So they were against the possibility of closing the Swedish investigation. Again, you ask yourself, why? I mean, this was a Swedish investigation about alleged rape. So what kind of interest the UK authorities and the Crown Prosecution Service had in keeping this investigation going on in a completely paralyzed situation? So the Swedish documents were absolutely crucial. But then, when I tried to go to the Crown Prosecution Service and ask for the complete correspondence, for the full correspondence with their Swedish counterpart, they refused to provide any document. So at that point, I have to sue them, getting lawyers, and we went to the tribunal. At that point, a few weeks before going to the tribunal, appearing before a tribunal, they started releasing me some documents, highly redacted. But these documents were really important. Why? Because thanks to these documents, my lawyers and I discovered that they had destroyed crucial emails about the case, because they were telling us, we did provide you all the documents we have, and we check, we discovered gaps. So for example, there were no emails about the week Julian had basically took refuge in the embassy. It was impossible that during that week the Swedish prosecutor and the UK Crown Prosecution Service had not communicated. There were no emails about the week Julian Assange had obtained asylum. Again, it was impossible that in that week they had not communicated. For example,
there were no emails about the week Julian had...
Can you hear me? All is well, the audio?
Yes, it's fine. Yes.
Okay. So basically, thanks to these gaps, we discovered, we asked my lawyers and I asked the UK Crown Prosecution Service, could you please explain why there are these crucial gaps in your correspondence? And it was at that point that they said, we don't know, we destroyed the documents. And we say, why you destroyed the documents? These are crucial documents about a criminal case which is still ongoing, is highly controversial, is high profile. Why did you destroy the documents? To this day, we are still fighting to discover why they destroyed the documents. No authority, no UK authority has asked a kind of inspection or investigation on the destruction of crucial emails. And I'm still fighting in the UK, in Sweden, in US and Australia to get the full documentation. You have to realize that the UK Crown Prosecution Service is basically the very same agency in charge of the US extradition request. And they have this story of destroyed documents, telling the Swedish prosecutors not to question him in London. So it's very suspicious the way they have behaved in this case. And now they are in charge of the UK extradition request. And before the tribunal, during my freedom of information litigation, they openly said that they will treat this extradition like an extradition of a mafia killer or a drug dealer or whatever. This is completely unacceptable. You cannot treat a journalist who's exposed war crimes, who exposed torture, who exposed serious human rights violation, as you are extraditing a drug dealer or a mafia killer. You cannot accept this. For me, it's completely unacceptable. And so I'm still fighting to get the old documentation. I have seven lawyers fighting in four jurisdictions, seven lawyers working for very little. And I'm tremendously grateful to them for this work, because I want to get the facts. As a journalist, I need to get the facts, and I don't want to give up. I want to use my safe position as a journalist to get Julian out of Belmarsh, to get him free and able to expose war crimes, and to get free and safe all the WikiLeaks journalists, because I feel this duty.
Stefania, thank you very much for that. And that brings me now to our final speaker. He was the ABC news chief in the Middle East. He's written for Newsweek. He's written for The Observer. He's been a very strong supporter of Julian Assange. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Charles Glass. He's on the line from Italy. Charles, I hope you're safe, and please do tell us your view on the political situation as it affects this case.
Well, I think one thing, maybe it is appropriate to be in Italy at the time of COVID-19 during this ordeal for Julian. I read a piece recently in Consortium News by Ray McGovern, a former intelligence agent, American intelligence agent, who's now in something called the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, who asked a very pertinent question. If WikiLeaks were running at full speed, as it was before Julian was confined because of the Swedish charges, wouldn't a lot of those whistleblowers have felt safe to bring their information to WikiLeaks about COVID-19 in the very early stages to alert the public about what was really happening and to push aside all of the disinformation that was coming out that caused the long delays in governments dealing with this problem? WikiLeaks was the safe locker for whistleblowers who wanted to bring to the attention of the public serious wrongs in the world, but without risking imprisonment themselves or loss of livelihood themselves. Remember that not many places are safe depositories. Remember back in 1983, when a British civil servant, Sarah Tisdall, knew that the British government was concealing the fact that the United States was going to deploy cruise missiles on British soil. Now, the Russians knew about this. Their spies knew about this. It wasn't a secret in the intelligence community. But the British public didn't know that its landscape was going to be used in this way with the attendant risks to British safety. But it was a matter of public concern, whether you were for it or against it. So she, as a conscientious civil servant, tried to bring it to the attention of her superiors who pushed it aside. So she took it to The Guardian. And The Guardian published the information, quite rightly, but when the government demanded the papers that she had provided it from The Guardian turned it over, she ended up in prison. So people don't feel safe with The Guardian or with the New York Times. The WikiLeaks was the safe place to go. Now its work is being constricted because its personnel are working most of the time to try and save Julian's life, to try and prevent either his dying of COVID-19 in Belmarsh prison or being sent to the United States and spending the rest of his life, 175 years under the Espionage Act charges, the rest of his life in a federal maximum security prison with people like El Chapo, the drug king, and mass murderers, serial killers, in solitary confinement for the rest of his life, where he would probably die long before his natural life ran out. This fate for Julian, either in Belmarsh or in American federal prison, has to be avoided at all costs. And WikiLeaks has to stay up and running as this place where whistleblowers can safely tell us, the public, what's going on. And I think one of the terrible tragedies of this whole case has been the perversion of the British justice system in order to get one man. Stefania has brought out these documents which show clearly that this prosecution of Julian is political. He's not a criminal, that it was responding to American wishes, as it always does, but that it was willing to pervert the entire course of justice. The very week that Justice Barrett, sir, sentenced Julian to 50 weeks for bail evasion, a man who had murdered someone and was on remand and had jumped bail, was given 3 months. Now, how is it that an alleged murderer gets less time than a man who has not committed any crime? Is it? The whole thing reeks to high heaven, and the sooner it's dealt with, the sooner that Julian is released, the sooner that the British stop perverting their own justice system in order to please the U.S., the sooner all these things happen, the better. And the better for us journalists, because Julian is taking the hit for us. As Stefania said, newspapers around the world published the WikiLeaks documents, the New York Times, El País, The Guardian, et al. But they're not being charged because these are big, powerful institutions. So the one who will take the hit was the man who provided them with the documents that gave them their scoops, that gave them their journalism prizes, that gave them their headlines. And a lot of them are not coming to his defense, which is, I think, disgraceful. In any case, I'm rambling on, but that's it for the moment.
Okay. Charlie, thanks very much for that. And one of the questions that's already coming up on the Q&A feed here, and please, if you're watching and you'd like to ask something, do just click on that at the bottom of your screens and you can ask a question, and I'll try and get as many of them as I possibly can into the panel while we're on air. But we've got about another half an hour, so we've got some time for those questions to be put and I hope answered by the panel. But let me just start off with this one, which, as I say, follows directly on from some of the points that Charlie made there. It's from Mick Dixon. He says, how can we put pressure on the media corporations to take this case up? I attended the Media Democracy Conference last year. It was packed. Many attendees must be working in some capacity in the mainstream media. They must have been there because they want to make an intervention somehow. How can we help them? And it seems to me that that's a really good question for a meeting about journalists and the Assange case. Now, Stefania, I'll come to you first. You've said a lot about your methods of work. They obviously aren't the methods of work of quite a lot of mainstream journalists. What's your view? What's your answer to Mick's question there? Stefania, would you need to...
Okay.
Unmute.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So based on my experience, I think it is crucial that readers put pressure on newsroom, email newsroom, and expose this silent and tell them that it's completely unacceptable that they are silent on such high-profile case. I know from colleagues in the US, they told me, well, we don't think we will cover extensively this case because we have coronavirus and we have an election. So they have run something like 3 years of campaign on Russiagate. And they are not covering the case, which is a case about the 2010 revelations. Revelation that they basically published. They got massive scoops. And they were able to run this campaign, the demonization campaign on Russiagate. And now that it's very clear that it's under trial, is on trial, and they want his extradition for exposing war crime, they are silent. It's completely unacceptable. So I think the readers should email regularly to the newsroom and expose this completely unacceptable behavior. I don't see any other solution. I mean, we cannot put a gun to their head. Only public pressure. We can use, that's all we have, you know.
Stefania, thanks very much for that. Charlie, I mean, you've been in major news corporations. What works in terms of getting a change in tone or a change of direction in the kind of coverage that they give a case like this?
Well, the only thing that really works is to buy it. So if you want to buy the New York Times and change the editorial policy, then that will work. Short of that, I don't know. At the moment, all journalistic organizations, the Reporters Without Borders, Committee to Protect Journalists, the journalistic branch of Amnesty, the National Union of Journalists in Britain, the Australian Journalist Union, and others have all come out in support of Julian and of WikiLeaks' right to publish. But the people who employ the individuals in these unions and organizations, the major publications and television networks are not coming to his defense and not really not even reporting it in the kind of detail that would be able to offset the huge governmental disinformation campaign against him. In fact, Stefan, if you want to do an interesting freedom of information request, try to find out the budget for the PSYOPs campaign against Julian in the United States and Britain. I would love to know the figure because I'm sure it is huge. All the time we are reading sheer libel against Julian, things that are not even remotely true that a lot of the public believe because this is being fed to the media by someone. And I'm sure that there's a huge budget for that purpose. And it's going to be very, very difficult to offset that. But I suppose the only thing is for the individual journalists who have used Julian's material, used the WikiLeaks material, to report this thing in detail regularly and to urge their editors to be fair.
Okay. John, just let me, there's a subsequent question here come in, which is pretty much in line with this discussion so far. So just let me read that and then I'll come to you. Kieran Tierney writes, I'd like your thoughts on how the major media outlets which benefited most from his leaks, the Guardian and the New York Times, seem to have been so quick to abandon Julian once he generated too much heat or no longer served a purpose for them. Now, this is a long and complex story, obviously, and it's had more than one twist in it, hasn't it? Because there's been a lot of hostility after they originally published the WikiLeaks revelations. But then more recently, when it became clear that actually Julian had been right all along and the question was extradition to the United States, we've had The Guardian change its editorial line. So there've been a few twists and turns in this. I know when I've spoken to Julian in jail, he said, look, it's not quite right to say that we don't have some mainstream media support. Actually, we do, and we shouldn't minimise that. So, John, what's your view of exactly where that balance is lying at the moment and what can be done about making it better than it is?
Yeah, I think we have to be very careful, John, in putting too much in store in this so-called balance. And I think enough has been said about The Guardian. The Guardian betrayed Julian right from the beginning. Much of what they reported on Julian was wrong. It was distorted. They won lots of prizes on it. I don't want to go on any more about The Guardian, but The Guardian is almost a case study of the very thing that we should be, in my view, abandoning. In my career as a journalist, I have to say, and I think it's worth looking at the broader landscape of the media, something very serious has happened in recent years. I'm not sure exactly when, but I do know that the spaces that were once there within the media, and I'm talking mainly about the UK, which is my experience, but I think that's true all over the world, certainly probably in the United States, those spaces that allowed in people like myself and others to do their work, even encouraged us, have closed. They don't exist anymore. And it's pie in the sky to think that they might exist. Yes, there are good people, amazingly, still at work and still able to have their work published. But by and large, the media represents what is probably the most misunderstood and the most important threat today, and that is propaganda. The media is an extension. We've seen that of established forces. It always has been. But there were, as I've said, there were places in the media where we could work. I mean, when I was on the Daily Mirror accommodated two of us, Paul Foote and myself. That would be impossible today. 6 years ago, I received a call from The Guardian saying they didn't want my work anymore. So did half a dozen other people. That's the end of it. And I think that has to be taken very, very seriously. At the same time, journalism schools are turning out and become factories for so much of the mainstream media. We have to ask ourselves, why is the media like this? It's made up of people. It's made up of journalists. Yes, Mick mentioned those people in the meeting. Now, when I made a film about the role of the media in the invasion of Iraq, I had no trouble speaking to BBC people on condition that they would speak anonymously. None of them would speak to me. All were terrified of what would happen to their careers if they spoke to me. But still, I think it's an important campaign as part of understanding, first of all, of freeing Julian, but also bringing some kind of freedom back to the dissemination of information, of understanding in so-called democratic societies, that there is a movement of journalists within media organizations. I think many of them are susceptible to understanding what Julian represents. Now it's very clear cut. Julian, as Charlie described so well, is on his way to the most terrible life or the end of his life in the United States because he was a journalist. And I believe that a lot of the hostility in the mainstream media is that Julian and WikiLeaks, by example, shame so much of journalism. WikiLeaks did what journalists should have been doing for a very long time. WikiLeaks produced more authentic scoops than all the journalists combined. And it set in motion a kind of, as it was almost as if Julian and WikiLeaks was revealing what the media had become, this closed shop, this agency of power instead of an agency of people. And that's something I think we really have.
Hello.
It's frozen.
John, are you still with us? Because sounds as if your sound disappeared on here.
I think you'll have to reconnect.
Okay, John, I think you might have to reconnect with us there. But thanks for that contribution. And I think it did address some of those questions. I see Mick Dixon's replied on the question and answer thing saying, John is so right here. So at least the questioner thought that you'd got that answer right. I'd like to just let you know that there's about 1,700 people following this on Twitter and hundreds more on Zoom and on Facebook. So I'm glad to see that the message is getting out to a wide audience. Some of the people following us now are saying that they'd like to talk a little bit more about the immediate situation. Of course, as for the rest of politics, the coronavirus has altered the debate. Here in Britain, there's a very extensive debate has blown up about the way in which the government is treating prisoners altogether during this crisis. And I have to say that rather like the government's whole response to the crisis, its response to the plight of prisoners has been particularly bad. It's been promising for weeks now to release at least some prisoners in order to lessen the chance of infection in prisons. Prisons, of course, as Julian's QC, Ed Fitzgerald, said when they made a bail application for him, are petri dishes for the spread of the coronavirus. The government has been promising to release large numbers of low-risk prisoners. It hasn't even done that. The numbers are still in double figures, as I understand, not the 4,000 that the government talked about, let alone the 15,000 that various prison reform charities and indeed the Prison Governors Association are saying are necessary. So I'd just like to get perhaps to go back to Charles Glass, just to have your view about this. We're all speaking from lockdown, of course, and you mentioned Julian's condition. Do you think that there's now a kind of, if you like, a shorter route or a more pressing question of Julian's release, at least on bail, because of this crisis?
Well, clearly, because of this crisis, he shouldn't be there at all. I mean, I'm, as an old libertarian and a former prison visitor, I'm against people being put in prison for victimless crimes in any case. Julian, there are no victims to Julian's alleged crimes. He doesn't belong there. That's first. Most of the people in the prison are there for drugs-related offenses. They don't belong there. You shouldn't be in prison for taking drugs. You should be either at home taking your drugs or on a rehabilitation program, but you're not a criminal. So if you were to deal fairly in the justice system, you wouldn't have an overcrowded prison. You wouldn't have the highest prison population in Europe. But these are fundamental questions that should have been addressed long before this crisis, in which case there probably wouldn't be such a crisis in the prison system. But there seems to be a lot of hope about that corona, COVID-19, will make us reconsider all of our priorities and the world will be a better place when it's all over. I doubt it. I think it'll go on pretty much the same way. I mean, if the First World War, when tens of millions of people died basically for nothing, didn't change anything, I don't think this will change anything either. Although I would like to think that it would. It is time to look at the whole prison system. It's time to look at the under-resourcing of the National Health Service, which should have been dealt with when the austerity program began, and it should have been stopped. The efficiencies that were forced on the NHS, efficiency meaning you only keep enough supplies for the day so that you don't have a large inventory piling up. Well, we see where that has led. It's led to health workers catching the virus because they can't be protected. There are lots of fundamental questions that this has thrown into relief, but which were always there, but were not being dealt with. I don't know that they will be dealt with later.
Stefani, let me put that issue to you as well. I mean, well, both issues really. The immediate question of Julian's safety in prison and what can and should be done about that, but also the issue that Charlie raised there. I mean, if there were ever a moment when an organisation like WikiLeaks were necessary, trying to get transparency out of government institutions about the coronavirus crisis is surely it.
Absolutely. I mean, and first of all, you have to realize that they feel the urgency to speak out about this situation precisely because of this coronavirus crisis, because I see an imminent risk to Julian Assange, because we know how bad the prison. He was not getting proper treatment even before. You can imagine now that there is such massive crisis and resources are very limited, and there is no chance to know what is really going on. If you try to file a freedom of information request in these days, it's highly problematic because they are busy with all sorts of people, all sorts of matters. So it's a real black hole. And in this black hole, they can do whatever they want. And I'm sure it will be very convenient for the UK authorities if Julian die out of coronavirus. No man, no problem. They will have not to face the problem of extradition and so on. So how convenient it would be for them. So I'm actually terrified about this situation. I'm actually terrified, especially if you consider how cruel they have been. I mean, if you go through the documents, the Freedom of Information Act documents I obtained from the Crown Prosecution Service, you realize they never, ever had any concern about this man inside the embassy, not allowing him to get treatment at the hospital, losing weight. How cruel his situation. And this cruelty is going on. They said, we won't release him because he's not serving a sentence, you know? They are not releasing him because he's not getting a sentence. This is completely mad. You should release people who are not serving a sentence, you know, and you should keep the very dangerous criminal in prison, or you should be careful they don't damage people. You, how mad it is admitting we are not releasing because he's not serving a sentence at all. That's completely mad. If we had serious media, they would destroy authorities like this. They would protest. They would say how absurd it is, all this situation. You have to realize that when the Russian journalist Golunov was arrested, the Russian journalists basically tried to protect him. They spoke out. They basically came out. They stood in solidarity, and it worked. So even the Russian journalists behave better than the Western journalists in this case, you know, because they stood in solidarity. And I'm sure if all the journalists who have worked, even just those who have worked on the document, speak out, I'm sure this case will be out in a few months. He will be out in a few months because they are putting him in prison for life for revealing war crimes. How can you accept this? I mean, it must be possible in a democracy to publish war crimes and to be free. This is what the freedom of the press in a democracy is supposed to be. You know, it must be possible. This is why I'm so obsessed about this case, because it goes beyond Julian. It goes beyond WikiLeaks. I want a society where you can expose war crimes and you can be free and safe. And I want to contribute to create this society through my journalism, because if you cannot expose war crime and be free, what kind of freedom, of the press you have, you know? You have the freedom of the press where you have the leaks, those approved by the government. We know that they publish, the New York Times, the Washington Post publish the leaks all the time, and they are authorized leaks. And they never have trouble. And when you don't have unauthorized leaks, unauthorized disclosures, revealing war crimes, that's where you get in trouble and you have your life destroyed. So I want to fight for this reason, even beyond Julian, even beyond WikiLeaks, because I want to contribute to create a society like this. And this coronavirus crisis give you the urgency to do this. I'm not sure if you realize that right now, as we speak in the UK, you have an intelligence agency, an infamous intelligence firm, Palantir, by Peter Thiel. And the first time I learned about this infamous intelligence firm collaborating with the CIA in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and with the immigration authorities in the US to fight migrant refugees. The first time I heard in my life about them was thanks to Julian Assange, because Palantir was basically enrolled by the Bank of America to prevent WikiLeaks publishing their documents. And they prepared an anti-WikiLeaks plan, which was basically what really happened, a dirty war to destroy the reputation of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And this is what has happened. So this Palantir has now been contracted by the UK National Health System to fight coronavirus. I will get mad to have my health data in the hands of such people. I don't know why the UK newspaper are not making a fuss. I would be completely mad. So it's in these times where we are under lockdown, there is no freedom of information, there is little coverage, we are working from homes. So we have limited opportunity to talk to people, to meet people and so on. It is in this time that we mostly need adversarial journalism, the kind of leaks we have thanks to WikiLeaks. Okay. So I want to fight, because it must be possible to do this kind of journalism. It must be possible to reveal war crimes and be completely free and safe, you know?
Okay. Stefani, thanks very much. John, let me come to you. There are some journalists, I think now, even some mainstream journalists, actually, very concerned about the fact that Julian's trial is planning, or the judge plans, for it to reconvene and go ahead on the 18th of May. Now, there's a requirement in this country that justice be seen to be done, that it be public justice. But what many journalists are saying is that it's difficult to see how that trial can be opened again in Belmarsh Magistrates Court just 9 days after the government has said that it's going to begin ending the lockdown. Now, we don't even know if the government can stick to that timetable. It hasn't managed to do so far. In your view, can there be a continuation of this trial which is fair under these conditions?
John, I think it's a wider thing there. And before, I mean, the Guardian must have shares in Zoom, I think, before I was lost. It's about journalism. And I accept that those two mainstream journalists you're probably quoting out of all the thousands that have remained silent during Julian's ordeal might be raising this question. But we're talking here about journalism. There should be, journalism is often rather romantically called a fourth estate. There should be a fifth estate now. It's no point, the idea that we should be somehow joining up with a mainstream media, which is closed as far as Julian's case, if anything proves that the mainstream, so-called misnamed mainstream media, is now closed to being a true media, it's Julian's case. There has to be a movement of journalists, and they can be journalists, as I think Nick's question brought up about journalists in particular who are prepared to go to public meetings, who are prepared to show their faces. But journalists have to speak up. That, in my view, that should be the message from this meeting. All journalists, wherever they are, for whom they're working, they need now to speak up, because the whole thing is so rotten. This what you've just raised about the court case starting 9 days later. Well, we both know that it's almost impossible for Julian's lawyers to have proper discussions with him. He doesn't have he's not given the facility, the time. For months he wasn't given the time. Even on the way to the court in late February, he was carrying court documents. They were taken from him. The whole thing is a farce. And it's only journalists acting as journalists playing what is basically a traditional role. What journalists right from the beginning, when they were agents of people, not power, that has to be returned to that. But the old fourth estate should be abandoned, and there has to be a different movement of journalists around the Julian Assange case. That's incredibly important because it's so urgent. But also it affects them, as I think you pointed out at the beginning. It affects all of them. If they're allowed to put Julian away, they can put anyone away. The intimidation is such that, and I can't remember who of us raised this question. I think it may have been Stefania, but all the questions raised about this coronavirus, the way it's been treated by stand up in front of lecterns which have written on it, protect the NHS, when they've spent decades, they and their cronies, destroying the NHS. You know, how much of this do we take? How much of this do journalists take? without speaking out, without investigating it. Hancock talking about personal protective equipment, one lie after the other. The same with Michael Gove talking about testing per month, one lie after the other. Now, why hasn't there been the kind of journalism that have held these people to account during this coronavirus crisis? I would suggest a lot of it has to do with their own fear that what has happened to Julian, even if it's subliminal, what has happened to Julian might happen to them. That has to end. Journalists are either going to be real journalists or not at all. That's a terribly important thing, and it should be said to young journalists, those who come into the craft with an idealism, and they still do, that it has to change, because without journalism, people don't have a voice, and that's what's been lost here.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks very much, John. And there's a number of questions, as you would expect, saying what can we do, how can we campaign. So just before I come back to the three panelists for a final round of questions, we've been going for an hour now. I just want to say this, campaigning always makes a difference. So if you don't follow the Don't Extradite Assange Twitter feed or Facebook page or Instagram or YouTube, please do. That always helps. We always need money to campaign. If you can make a donation, please do. And please participate as fully as you possibly can in any of our activities. When we get back on the streets, please join us there. But in the meantime, do share this. The last time we did a broadcast like this, it was seen by some 80,000 people in the 24 hours after we made it. That's pretty much coming up on the Guardian's daily sale at the moment. So don't lose faith in the ability of social media to play a role here. So that'll be the last word you hear from me, apart from to say goodbye to you all. Thanks for watching. As I say, there are thousands of people watching this broadcast. But just to wrap it up, I want to go back to the panelists and ask them this. We've talked a lot about Julian's plight, and it's certainly a serious one. But the question I want to ask you now is, what will be the condition of journalism if the American government is successful in extraditing Julian Assange and is successful in prosecuting him? What would that mean for the practice of journalism? Charles Glass, let me come to you first about that.
Well, I think more than the practice of journalism, it'll be the safety of people like Chelsea Manning or Sarah Tisdall or Clive Ponting, if you remember, or Daniel Ellsberg, the people who bring information to journalists, either directly or through WikiLeaks. Where will they go? Whom can they trust when they see the man that was protecting them and bringing their information to the public, seeing him behind bars for the rest of his life, and not even defended by his colleagues in much of the media? That I think that'll be a bigger problem. Much of journalism today, in any case, if you pick up a newspaper or watch a broadcast, 75% of it is about fashion and actors and the Kardashians. Very little of it is serious news reporting. So I don't think the effect on journalism as it is practiced today will be as great as the loss of potential sources for the serious information we need to make decisions about our lives.
Stefania, just give me a brief summary answer about where you think journalism will be if we don't win this.
To be honest, I think it will be devastating, because it will set a devastating precedent where you cannot expose war crimes, neither as a source like Chelsea Manning, and nor as a journalist, because don't forget, you can do journalism, great journalism, if you have great sources who take huge risks, but also great publishers. If you don't have good journalists like Julian, like WikiLeaks, who have the guts to publish this information, you can have the fantastic source you want. The information will not come out in the way he should be. So if they can destroy Julian, if they can destroy journalists like Sarah Harrison, let's not forget her name, who flew Hong Kong to help one of the biggest journalists of all sources of all times, Edward Snowden. If we not can have this, well, why to do journalism if you cannot expose war crimes and torture safely? I mean, what's the purpose of journalism?
John, last word from you.
Well, I don't think it make any difference whatsoever. I think journalism has changed. It's been silenced. It's been silenced from within. There's been a sort of defenestration of the best. The best journalists are always those who go against the grain, who are mavericks, people like Charlie and Stefania and others, people, great investigative journalists like Seymour Hersh now, can't get published in the United States. People have been thrown out. So journalists, those who want to be journalists, those who understand how important journalism is, have to make the changes themselves. That's where the campaign should be heading. Yes, undoubtedly, the mainstream media has great power. Of course it does. And persuading them to be something that they're not may be a noble cause, but I think it's rather a lost one. We have to change journalism itself.
John Pilger, Stefania Maruzzi, and Charles Glass, thank you very much for being with us. I can see from the comments that people are deeply appreciative. Wonderful contributions from Stefania, Mr. Pilger, and Charles. There's Anthony Walsh, and there's a number like that. So thanks very much for being with us. To the rest of you watching, thanks for joining us. I've really only got this to say. Do remember the words of Steve Biko, the great anti-apartheid activist, when he said the most powerful weapon in the hand of the oppressed is the mind of the oppressed. So don't ever think that sharing a video like this, or signing a petition, and there are ones on the DEA website, or writing to your MP, or participating in a protest, never think that it doesn't matter. That's the thing that's sustaining your freedom. It'll be the thing that ultimately wins Julian Assange his freedom. So stay strong, stay organized, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.